Alium readers, Alium listeners, thanks for being with us. I am Derek Monette, the Deputy Editor-in-Chief of the Academic Life and Emergency Medicine blog. Today we are bringing you a special follow-up podcast with the author of a recent hit post, Update on the ED Management of Intracranial Hemorrhage. Dr. Debbie Yee Madhawk is here to answer questions related to this important topic. She is an assistant clinical professor in the UCSF Department of Emergency Medicine, fellowship trained in neurocritical care, and co-author of this post that gained over 10,000 views in its first month. Dr. Madhawk, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. I'm a huge Alium fan, so it's a pleasure being here.
Fantastic. So let's dive right in. One point that your post brings up is the issue of whether in intracranial hemorrhage is seizure prophylaxis indicated. It seems that it's only indicated in traumatic bleeds, but not necessarily in atraumatic. Is that accurate? And can you speak to that a little bit?
That is accurate. And it's important to note that it's not indicated in all traumatic bleeds, specifically isolated acute traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhages with a good GCS. And this is a good time to clarify the indications of seizure prophylaxis in traumatic brain injury. So the indications for seizure prophylaxis in traumatic brain injury are depressed skull fracture, acute subdural or epidural hematoma, hemorrhagic contusion, penetrating head trauma, a seizure within the first 24 hours, and GCS less than or equal to 10. And then what I mentioned about it not being indicated in acute traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhages with a good GCS is that these patients act a little bit differently than other traumatic brain injury patients and have a lower risk of seizures early on, as well as having better outcomes. So in these patients, good GCS, traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage, you do not need to provide seizure prophylaxis for these patients.
So that makes sense. Thanks for explaining that important point. Related to this topic of seizure prophylaxis, is there any risk to giving prophylaxis in an atraumatic bleed, such as a spontaneous aneurysm rupture?
Well, obviously every medication has a risk. And the most common short-term risks with giving seizure prophylaxis is sedation. And if you're talking about giving prophylaxis, therefore giving an anti-epileptic drug before a seizure has occurred, we really need to weigh the risks versus the benefits. So when you're talking about giving seizure prophylaxis in subarachnoid hemorrhage, and that is a non-traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage, seizure prophylaxis has actually been associated with an increased risk of neurological deterioration, vasospasm, and elevated temperature. And elevated temperature is something the brain definitely doesn't like. And when treated with phenytoin, subarachnoid hemorrhage patients actually had worse short-term cognitive outcomes. And if you're talking about primary, so spontaneous intracranial hemorrhages, giving seizure prophylaxis with phenytoin without a seizure was associated with worse outcomes at 90 days. So in non-traumatic ICH, we do not give seizure prophylaxis.
Okay. That actually makes much more sense at this point. And related to phenytoin, since you brought it up, my institution seems to favor Keppra over phenytoin. In fact, I'm 4 or 5 years into residency now, and I don't know that I've ever actually ordered phenytoin. So your post and the Brain Foundation cite phenytoin as the preferred agent for seizure prophylaxis. Could you speak to why phenytoin is the recommended agent and where this discrepancy in practice culturally or regionally may come from?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. You know, I've talked about brain bleeds at different conferences, and the question that people always ask me is why they're giving levetiracetam, i.e. Keppra, instead of phenytoin when I talk a lot about phenytoin being indicated for traumatic brain injury or for specifically for severe traumatic brain injury. So Brain Trauma Foundation is the go-to for the evidence-based guidelines in traumatic brain injury. And they have an amazing website if you want to basically go through. There's like a couple of hundred pages where they outline how to manage severe traumatic brain injury on their website. So giving an anti-epileptic drug for traumatic brain injury is based on the 1990 Temkin et al. RCT in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what it showed was that there was a reduction in early post-traumatic seizures with phenytoin versus giving placebo. So you ask, like, why are patients being given levetiracetam instead? So in 2013, Inaba et al. Showed no difference in the rate of post-traumatic seizures between levetiracetam compared with phenytoin. But the study included moderate and severe TBI patients. So for severe TBI patients, since we have this RCT comparing phenytoin versus placebo, we still use phenytoin. And for moderate TBI, you can, you know, that's kind of like a hazy area. And a lot of hospitals are replacing phenytoin or fosphenytoin with levetiracetam. And then other hospitals might be using other agents as well. So for moderate TBI or mild TBI, neurosurgery can use their judgment. But the Brain Trauma Foundation is still recommending the use of phenytoin and in many hospitals, fosphenytoin for seizure prophylaxis in severe traumatic brain injury.
Okay. And you bring up one point that is something I'd like to clarify. You mentioned mild TBI, you mentioned moderate TBI. Is that referring to your GCS score? Is that more of a gestalt that you have in taking care of these patients? Could you tell us in the ED how we can flush out which patient falls into which category?
Yeah, so I think that's an awesome question. So ED docs don't commonly look at traumatic brain injury based on their GCS, but that is how traumatic brain injury is classified. It's based on your GCS. I know that ED docs, we commonly look at, is there a finding on CT or is there not a finding on CT? But severe TBI is classified as a patient with a GCS of less than or equal to 8. And moderate TBI is classified as a GCS of 9 to 12. And mild TBI is classified as a GCS of 13 to 15.
Okay, perfect. Thanks for the clarification. We're going to take a step back for a second and switch gears. I'd like to speak with you a little bit about blood pressure goals in intracranial hemorrhage. For atraumatic causes of bleed, such as a ruptured aneurysm, blood pressure management focuses on preventing a high systolic pressure. But for a traumatic head bleed, the goal is a systolic blood pressure greater than 100 or 110, depending on age. This can certainly be confusing for providers. Why the difference in approach?
Okay, so I think that when you're thinking about how to manage the blood pressure, you should really think about what has caused the bleed. Okay, so when you're thinking about an aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, you have to remember that there's a big artery in the brain that has an outpouching, right, that has ruptured, and there's blood that's going through that artery and continue to leak out of that aneurysm. Okay, so when you're talking about aneurysmal subarachnoid hemorrhage, we actually want to keep the blood pressure lower until the aneurysm has been secured or aneurysm has been coiled or clipped. So we typically recommend a blood pressure less than 140 to 160. And once that aneurysm has been secured, it's a totally different game. You want to get blood flowing again so you can liberalize your blood pressure goal. In spontaneous ICH, those are hypertensive in origin. Okay, so you're talking about small arteries connected to big intracerebral arteries, small arteries that have changed over years of hypertension. So in those, you kept the blood pressure very high, that it wouldn't be good because those could continue to bleed. Spontaneous ICHs, actually 30% of them expand in the first 3 hours. And that's why neurointensivists are pretty aggressive about lowering the blood pressure. We aim for somewhere between less than 140 to 180. And the reason why it's this murky recommendation that keeps on changing over time is because the evidence actually keeps on changing. So whatever I tell you today and whatever it says in the blog post, just remember that next year it could be completely different. And then in traumatic brain injury, you know, you have to remember that there's all different kinds of mechanisms, but you have to remember that this little formula, okay? And the formula is cerebral perfusion pressure, or CPP, equals the mean arterial pressure minus the intracranial pressure. So when you're talking about TBI, you think that there's something inside the skull. The skull's a rigid box. It doesn't like to have anything extra in there. When there is something extra in there, that the pressure goes up, and that's intracranial pressure. So when ICP, or intracranial pressure, goes up, the cerebral perfusion pressure, right, the pressure perfusing the actual brain tissue, is going to go down unless the mean arterial pressure goes up. So that's why when you have these patients, so just think back to some of your patients that have come through the ED, some of those sick traumatic brain injury patients that come in through your ED, some of them you see and they come in with a really high blood pressure. And that's your brain trying to do its job. And we call that autoregulation. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that we're maintaining a good MAP for this patient to maintain good brain perfusion. And this is actually panned out in literature for traumatic bleeds. The evidence is based on, you know, there's so-so studies, but there's a lot of these so-so studies, okay? And a class two study that is commonly referenced is Barry et al. Study in injury in 2012. And what happened was they basically looked at about 15,000 isolated blunt, moderate to severe TBI patients with a wide age range and with admission systolic blood pressures less than 60. And then they basically looked at sequentially increasing the admission systolic blood pressure. And there was actually an increased odds of mortality with an SPP less than 110 on admission. Okay. And we saw that there was some variability with age, hence why the recommendations are a little bit different based on your age. But I think a pretty safe goal is you want to have SPP greater than 110 in these patients with traumatic brain injury.
Do you have a preferred agent for acutely lowering the blood pressure? And related to your last couple of points, would you ever actually use an agent to increase the cerebral perfusion pressure for a patient with a traumatic brain injury?
Yeah, so my go-to for lowering blood pressure in ICH is nicardipine. And if it's hard, I know that it's sometimes hard to get your hands on nicardipine really quickly in the ED. And I think it's fine then to give, a push of IV labetalol before you can hang your IV nicardipine drip. And then the other option is if you can get your hands on clavitipine, which is kind of like nicardipine short-acting cousin, this is a great choice too. We aren't currently carrying clavitipine in my hospital yet, but I'm really looking forward to trying it out. And then when it comes to raising the blood pressure, maybe we haven't seen it that much in the ED, but yes, absolutely we raise blood pressures to support cerebral perfusion pressure. It's the kind of thing we do in the neuro ICU, and we might be using norepinephrine for that. Most important is really in these traumatic brain injury patients, if you're having issues with ICP, the most important thing it really is most likely to get the patient to the operating room. And then, if we're still dealing with ICP issues after that, that's something that typically happens in the neuro ICU, and we might be managing blood pressure acutely, after the patient has gone to the OR.
Perfect. That makes sense. So we've talked about seizure prophylaxis. We've talked about the tricky balance of blood pressure control in this population. I'd like to finish with a couple questions on a topic that we didn't touch upon in the blog post. Platelets and indications for transfusion, which seems to be an increasingly robust area of study. The PATCH trial from The Lancet in 2016 showed us that for patients on an antiplatelet agent at home, like aspirin or Plavix, and now in the ED with a non-traumatic head bleed, giving them a platelet transfusion may actually increase the risk of an adverse event in hospital. Could you comment on this? Were you surprised?
Like I said, every medication has a risk. Nothing in life comes free. So for me, the results of the PATCH trial weren't at all surprising. It doesn't really make sense to me why a platelet transfusion would reverse the action of aspirin. And actually, for the PATCH trial, like you said, the odds of death or dependence were greater in patients who received a platelet transfusion at 3 months. But I think that I have to look at every case individually. And anecdotal evidence from neurosurgeons is that patients on aspirin or Plavix, they bleed like stink in the operating room. And to my neurosurgical colleagues, giving platelet transfusions seem to help. So if this is a non-traumatic head bleed and the patient is going to require some sort of neurosurgical procedure, such as an external ventricular drain insertion or a craniectomy, I will defer to my colleagues because I'm not operating on the patient. I will defer if they think that they need to have a platelet transfusion and that helps, then I will defer to them. But in the ED or neuro ICU, I'm not giving platelet transfusions to these patients. If my neurosurgery colleagues don't need it and they're not going to the operating room, I'm not going to be giving a platelet transfusion to these patients.
Great. So it sounds like your practice has matched the result of the PATCH trial that we saw in 2016.
Yeah, and I think that most neurointensivists were doing this prior to the results of the PATCH trial.
Dr. Yu Madhok, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us and deliver this amazing, clear content. I want to finish by giving you a chance to add any final points that you think are important, either related to neurocritical care, or tell us something about a project you're currently working on.
Okay, thank you so much. I chose to be a neurointensivist, an ED neurointensivist, so that I can improve pre-hospital and ED care of neuro emergencies. My current baby, besides my own two babies at home, is the Mission Protocol. And the Mission Protocol is basically my hospital. So Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital's Mission Protocol is a direct EMS to CT scanner protocol with the goal of expediting CT, IVTPA, and endovascular therapy for acute stroke patients. So for those of you who know my hospital, San Francisco's only safety safety net hospital, and mission protocol is need blind. So I'm hoping to show that need blind expedited care to endovascular therapy has better outcomes and closes the gender, race, insurance status gap in stroke care. So this is my baby. I'm hoping that I can report on this in a couple of months or a year back on Allium. And I'm hoping really to be a model for the rest of the country to show that need blind expedited care to endovascular therapy is the best care for stroke patients.
Dr. Umadhoc, I'm going to resist the urge to ask you more questions about that, but social EM combined with neurocritical care makes for quite a fascinating career. Thank you so much again for taking time to be with us today. And this is Derek signing off for the Allium team.